We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. We're very honored to have on today's program Hadley Arks, the founder and director of the James Wilson Institute, as well as the Edward Ney Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence at Amherst College. Thank you so much for joining us, Hadley.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me and Emily.
Absolutely. Now, you've worked very closely on the issue of Roe, the issue of life for many, many years. And I guess probably a good place to start is just I want to ask what your reaction was when, you know, we anticipated what the decision would be because of that awful leak. But when the decision came down last week, what was your reaction, just as somebody who's worked so closely on this issue for so many years?
Well, everyone was just so grateful and relieved and just enthused to hear that it had finally come. Some of us never thought it wouldn't have come in our lifetime. But at the same time, the people who were marching in the March for Life all those years were concerned about babies being killed in wombs. I never heard anybody seeing somebody carrying a sign saying the court has overreached its jurisdiction. And we also knew that under the current perspective of conservative jurisprudence, the wrong that they thought was done in Roe versus Wade was the wrong of removing the issue from the hands of the people as voters and legislators. And the corrective was to send it back to the states without pronouncing on the rightness or wrongness of abortion itself. And that's what we saw at work in this case. Nothing was that curious line of the dissenters that you're saying that a woman has no rights to abortion even at the first moments. No, they never said that. They pronounced no judgment on the rightness or wrongness of abortion in those first moments. That whole question, the moral judgment on that matter would be left to the states. So years ago, those lawyers in Roe versus Wade put together the most elegant brief, drawing upon the most updated findings in embryology of the age, woven with principled reasoning, to establish this point that that offspring in the womb has never been anything other than human from its first moments, that it receives its nourishment from its mother, but it has never been part of the body of the mother. Now, the court, the dissenters in Roe never picked up on that. They never picked up on picking up on it, what they could have said was, this decision was wrong because the lawyers for Texas had established the compelling grounds on which to explain why the people in the separate states, the people in Texas were quite justified in casting the protections of the law over the small human being residing for a while in a womb. Now, they didn't say that. They never put in place the notion, this is what it's about. And if they had done that, then all these years we'd have a sense of what is at the center of the problem. So I said there's a couple of tears. I made the connection to the Emancipation Proclamation, as Lincoln issued it, because it was a war measure. It was to strike at slavery in the states that were at war with the government, to try to strike at their means of keeping people in the field while having slaves do the labor. The Emancipation Proclamation could do nothing to free those slaves held in border states like Delaware and Missouri. And someone said that because of that, the Emancipation Proclamation had all the moral force of a bill of lading. And yet, the sense took hold right away that there was an anti-slavery premise driving that thing. It was an anti-slavery, animating anti-slavery passion. And I think my hope is that that's what this decision will yield. And there's an oddity, though, I think, Emily, as the thing is played out in the pro-life states, and it's challenged in the pro-life states, the lawyers, even the conservative judges in those states, would finally be moved to do what I've been wishing for years, the judges and Roe would have done, because they were faced with this question: why are you justified in casting the protections of the law on a child from the point of birth, from the point of conception, early in the pregnancy? Why do you go past viability? Why not 7 weeks? Why not 6 weeks? In order to do that, they have to go back. And by the way, I can say that Sam Alito at least put the points in place. He said, if we recognize that the child in the womb has a claim to be protected after viability, why can't the same child have a claim to be protected before viability? In other words, he's making the point that this is the same entity. It's the same entity developing over time. All the genetic items are in place. That's the entity. It will come out, and you'll give a name. This is Joy Epstein. They we're giving out a name, but it is nothing other than the same entity. And we also understand that once we're clear that this is a human being, this is what it looked like at every moment, then we used to understand that the laws on homicide were utterly indifferent to the size and weight of the victim. The killing of an older man is not a worse killing than the killing of a child. But it seems what may be happening, what Hegel could call the cunning of history, is things work in such a way that the conservative judges in the separate states will find themselves compelled to reason precisely along these lines. And in doing that, they will truly get at the substance of the decision, the way that the court in this case consciously stepped around that central matter of substance.
Let's talk about that, because your initial piece of writing in reaction to this decision was to talk about the end of the beginning. I probably mixed that up. The end of the beginning.
That's right. It's the end of the beginning.
The end of the beginning.
You say you're finding something wrong with Roe versus Wade. You're dislodging it as some kind of a right anchored in the Constitution itself.
Okay, right.
That's critical.
Right.
And
folks can read that over at the James Wilson website, anchoringtruths.org. You can go ahead and read that piece. But how did the decision itself, in its substance, set up the battle, or set the table for the battle that is now going to take place on the state level for decades to come?
Well, doesn't set it up in a way that I could find appealing or congenial or even useful, because I did that at one of the pieces. I said it makes a profound difference as to how they send it back to the states. They could say, look, we are clear that this entity in the womb has never been anything other than a human being from its first moments. So we send it back to you to consider, get your judgment on how the taking of this life is meshed, reconciled with your ongoing laws on homicide. When do you think it's apt to start protecting? What moves do you think, the methods you think would be apt? Let's see, that's one. The second one, I'm afraid, was one taken by a very dear friend of mine, Anthony Scalia, to say, and it's been picked up. We cannot speak about the truth of this matter. In fact, Brett Kavanaugh made that one of his premises. We cannot speak about the truth of when human life begins. Therefore, we send the matter back to the states to let people make value judgments. Now, on when they think life begins. Value judgments, that's a term that began with Nietzsche and Max Weber. When people stop speaking about moral truths, they talk about thinking have value because we impute value. So you raise the question, how much are you inclined to impute value to that offspring? Does that seem to you human being? Is that something you want to credit as human being? Well, when the matter is cast in that way, and it's sent back to the state, it's simply a matter of beliefs. So the people who are resistant are saying right now, You're simply imposing your beliefs on them. You said giving us a whole record of the laws passed in this country, say in the middle of the 19th century, when the medical profession was joining a surge to firm up those laws on abortion in the states. We have an impressive list put forth by Samuel Alito. The other side looks at it and says, all you've shown us is what people at an earlier time believed. Instead of saying, the record here reveals affirming understanding of the nature of that offspring in the womb, so that those judgments, the judgments contained in those laws in the 1860s, were as valid then as they are now, because they are grounded in the same truths that can command our respect. So one of my concerns, Emily, is that if it's cast as a matter of simply valid judgments and beliefs, so when it gets back to the states, people say, I thought I had this right, this constitutional right, and it wouldn't disappear from me when I move from one state to the other. Now you tell me I don't have it because there's some critical point I'm obliged to respect, but because 51% of the people around me do not think I ought to have it. So what I said, I think I was, of course, hoped that we could have done better than that. I was hoping that the court might deliver itself to a firmer judge. And the simplest way was just to recall the path open to us by that elegant brief written by the lawyers for Texas in 1972-73. What it means is simply say, you're saying that there are ample grounds in embryology, woven, as I say, with principle. There's no principle ground, which we explain why that offspring in the womb is anything less than human. No ground in which we can say that, that would not apply to many people walking about outside. This doesn't speak at, neither do deaf needs. Doesn't seem to have arms and legs, and other people lose arms and legs in the course of their lives without losing anything necessary to their standing as human beings to receive the protections of the law.
It's basically what Christopher Hitchens believed, actually.
Christopher was on my side on that one.
Yes.
He debated with me about capital punishment in New York about 25 years ago. Yeah.
But on life, he said there's really no way to deny scientifically, biologically, that child is alive.
When did you see that as an old piece of Christopher's? When did you come across that?
So I came across that this spring. I think it was after the leak itself. I went back and looked because a colleague of mine, David Harsanyi, had cited that in the past. And he actually talked about it several times that are recorded on tape or in print. Sort of a fascinating.
No. Chris was very, very good at that. Yeah, he was tough.
Yes. So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. mypillow.com/Federalist. But your point is well taken, and I wonder what you thought of Justice Thomas's concurring opinion. He sort of got into the due process question and whether some of these other rights that have been found by the court over the years are perhaps built on somewhat of a house of cards. What did you make of Justice Thomas's take?
I credit him with having sort of like people like Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who've had experience in politics, come through experience in the executive and experience in the judiciary, also arrive with a certain kind of political sense. So I thought it was strange that he chose this moment to unfold that argument again, because he knows he has very few supporters. He can claim very little support among his own colleagues to make that argument. And as he did that, he put in place, he firmed up the opposition, saying, you're saying all of these earlier rights, contraception, interracial marriage, were drawn from the due process clause. And they're all just sort of foul rights, just false rights. Well, if that's what you're saying, well, then those rights truly are open to question now, aren't they? Because if your test now is, remember the test is, when it comes to the due process clause, the conservatives don't want to speak about the rightfulness, the truth of any of the grounds of any of those early rights. They simply want to say, is it a right long recognized in our tradition? Well, you go back to, say, contraception. No, it was not a right long recognized. There were still laws against contraception on the books when that decision was handed down in 1965. When the court struck down interracial marriage, there's still about half the states still had these lingering, probably unenforced decisions about barring marriage across racial lines. These old precedents can't be sustained on that basis. To sustain them, you have to break away from this matter test of whether, how long have they been around, and so on, to say this, to test the substance of say, we think it was quite justified for the laws to strike down those laws that barred the marriage of people across racial lines. Wrong to deny contraception to married couples, of BEPS, not wrong to restrict access to contraception on the part of unmarried youngsters, as Justice White remarked in that case. But at the same time, there's a notable difference between something involving a lethal operation, taking another life, taking the life of an innocent being. And for the sake, in order to reach that point, you have to explain that your reasons for taking that fetal life are as compelling as the reasons we demand in any other case for the taking of human life. So, see, my point is, I think the justice overdone it on this question of substantive due process. The great Thomas Cooley in his commentaries said that even then in the 1870s would say the due process clause really represents the great principles, the principles contained in this regime, even if they weren't set down in the Constitution. And Daniel Webster, the old Dartmouth College case, said, no, it's not enough that something be simply passed with all the trappings of legality, with a vote of a majority. Something may be passed that way, and it may still lack the very substance of justice. An interesting case here may be for him. If, I don't know if you want to follow this track. I don't want to, that it's too much inside baseball, but remember, we have Brown versus Board that struck down segregation in schools of Topeka, and they used the Equal Protection Clause. At the same day, the court struck down racial segregation in the schools of the District of Columbia, Golding versus Sharp. But District of Columbia was not a state. They couldn't use the Equal Protection Clause. So they invoked the Due Process Clause. And I'm almost tempted to ask my friend Justice Thomas, I think, do you think that was a matter of substantive due process? That was wrongfully decided? That you couldn't find with the Due Process Clause the same thing we're finding here in the wrongness of drawing moral inferences about the worth of people on the base of race, as though the people you're dealing with were not indeed moral agents who were responsible for their own acts. I think that the principle here is just deeply embedded in the very logic of a regime of law. So yes, I tend to say substantive due process are us at the James Wilson Institute. That's what we do. we don't apologize much for it. But anyway, my concern about this is that it was easy. My friend Clarence Thomas has been, Justice Thomas has been very concerned about that over the years, about substantive due process. So he felt obliged to sort of move to sort of say it again and raise that flag again. But I think others wonder why was it especially apt at this moment to raise it? Were you simply fueling the claims on the other side that as a result of what you've done here, you're putting all those earlier precedents at risk? And if you're not talking about the substance of what you're doing, if you're simply telling us, oh, it's a matter of how long it's been around, well, they have a point. If you're not dealing with the very substance of the case, to tell us why those earlier precedents can be regarded as justified with an enduring claim to be recognized even now.
That's fascinating. And it actually makes me wonder what you think about how Ruth Bader Ginsburg would have dissented. She's a long critic, obviously you know this, a longtime critic of the Roe decision itself. How do you think if she were alive to decide Dobbs or to be involved in the Dobbs case, how do you think she would have dissented? She would have dissented.
She would have sounded very much like the dissenters here. Remember when one of those cases on marriage, when she said that if the wives of my colleagues were voting, I think this would have come out in a different way. Now, she knew, she's very close with Maureen Scalia. She had to know that that wasn't true. She probably come very close to what the dissenters here are saying when saying, oh, you said at the time of the 14th Amendment, the states were firming up the laws barring abortion. The 14th Amendment never contained, but the 14th Amendment, they say, was passed by men. People had gave no standing to women in the political system. Women were not recognized as fellow citizens with the power to vote and to engage in these deliberations. Therefore, we have to assume that the men who framed and ratified the 14th Amendment, or the men voting for those pieces of legislation in separate states, had no awareness, no sympathy or sensitivity to the interests of women, to recognize why women may be deeply concerned about this matter that bears on their bodies, and why they would have what's at stake for the women in this matter of abortion. Now, all that's interesting, but it's playing the whole thing through the prism of gender identity. Mm-hmm. And it's utterly detached from the question, do you understand what that bloody surgery is about? You're talking about the poisoning or dismembering of another human being. Remember my friend Dan Robinson used to say, your right of your own body does not give you the right to rent your body for the pleasure of others or to inject a heroin into your body. And still less does your right over your body give you the right or the warrant for poisoning and dismembering another body. And what, you know, this is my dissatisfaction with India as we come out of this decision. The other side is animated by these slogans. You're being deprived of reproductive rights, the woman's control of her own body. And the apt response should be, when did the control of your own body give you the authority or the justification for destroying another life? But instead of getting that, what we're hearing from the former clerks of the court is, well, it was never part of the Constitution. That was a mistake from the beginning. But it's not needing the moral argument that's coming up now. So if you look now, you'd almost think all the passion is on the side of the opponents of the decision. My hunch, though, is that the pro-life side will show real energy here. Because after all, it is that energy that has sustained this movement over 49. You know, come think of it, Emily. Brown versus Board was in 1954. It's only 10 years from that to the point where this Congress could enact the Civil Rights Act of 1964, banning racial discrimination, all places of public accommodation. We don't have to make distinctions between restaurants and drugstores. I think it was a sweeping general proscription applying prospectively. It took only 10 years. The country had come around finally to support that view. 49 years after Roe, we still have these lingering divisions. Hmm. And in fact, the other side, we found recently, though, from my own work on this matter preserving, protecting the child who survives the abortion, we now find even people on former President Obama saying that it's unconstitutional to try to protect the child who survives the abortion. That right to an abortion does not merely extend to the entire pregnancy, but even when the baby comes out. The right to abortion then may be the right to an effective abortion or a dead child. And somebody points out, it's kind of Marxist argument. And
yes.
It's easier for me to kill this thing than to give away what is mine. Mm-hmm. You know, you can understand that passion. But look, we've come to a point where, no, half the country has not acquiesced in this claim. That's not what we had just 10 years after Brown versus Board. That's a lingering side of something. And that it took a remarkable endurance, steadfastness for people to preserve their commitment to come out year after year for the pro-life, to work in their separate states, to work at every point. That is not going to flag. Mm. That will keep up. And that I think will sustain itself.
Cancel culture is coming to your bank, and holding the wrong political views might soon leave you out in the cold. I'm Bill Walton. On the latest episode of The Bill Walton Show, Todd Zwicky, Paul Watkins, and I discuss what is already happening, how the Biden administration is already pursuing this agenda, and what we can do about it. This progressive culture offensive is relentless. It's coming for you, and you won't hear about this anywhere else. Follow The Bill Walton Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, that's such an interesting point. I want to get into more of that. The experience you had observing what is not commonly considered a civil rights movement, but certainly is over the course of the last half decade, develop and then develop a sure. lot of influence, build a lot of influence. And that's the pro-life movement. You write in your piece that folks can read over at Anchoring Truths, you say, everything might have been caught in one glance with Red Skelton's old joke, reflecting a culture that has fled. Quote, they had a military wedding, or I think they had a military wedding. Let's put it this way. There were guns there. That joke from a culture that has disappeared simply reminded us that even in Dogpatch USA, the denizens could never imagine that if a woman became pregnant, they were free to simply get rid of it or throw it away. It has required a generation teeming now with the college educated to deliver us from those simple moral recognitions, so primitive and so true. So with all of that context, what do you credit with the overturning of Roe? Is it the pro-life movement? Is it technology? How do all of these variables and factors work together over half a century to culminate in the decision in Dobbs?
It's the pro-life movement that has brought it about. The pro-life movement has formed the intellectual force and the moral passion. But the problem is it's all been refracted through pro-life lawyers, to the conservative lawyers, not pro-life, conservative lawyers who think they have to speak this way in making it into something that's legal. You know, there's that old line of Justice Holmes from The Path of Law saying, it was his aspiration, the aspiration of the modern project of law, to banish all words of moral significance from the law altogether. Maybe you make moral judgments, that that's not what lawyers do. That's not what judges do. And when I see that the writings of Brett Kavanaugh and others say, no, we have nothing to say. We have no truth to pronounce on the human standing, the child. You can't read a textbook in embryology. You can't take account of this. You find people conservatives actually saying moral judgments are not things that judges should make. They should go back to the states where people simply make, quote, these value judgments with no claims to represent any anchoring truth, but to have things that have value because most of us really think they have value and impart value to them. So it's, think about that. I say that's a joke that's fled. Really, I mentioned that piece, you know, it was not so hard for me. When I was a youngster, somebody, a teenager, became pregnant, that people understood that's the end of childhood. Mm-hmm. She and her boyfriend would have to quit school and somebody would get a job. And I know a couple friends like that who came through nicely, by the way, after all. But you know, there was a marvelous paper I had in my course in political obligations at Amherst, my signature course, from which a book called First Things sprang. And at the end, there's a paper on abortion if the students wish to write it. There's one 19-year-old woman who wrote, and she said, she looked at the arguments on abortion. She said, I have to confess that when looked at in a demanding way, abortion would be very hard to justify. It'd be far easier to justify protecting that child. But then she said, but I have to say candidly that if I were pregnant, and in that position, the interest bearing on me would probably be more powerful than that moral argument I've just reviewed. I've seen that before. But then she took a turn I had never seen, Emily. She said, but isn't that why we have laws on the subject? That is, we have laws because the laws can contain a certain kind of wisdom that may not be available to a 19-year-old. Under immense pressure, embarrassed before her family, especially when her fellow will not stand behind her. The laws, as she used to say, those laws provided both shelter and guidance. So you know that line of Thomas More's that if we struck down the laws, we'd all be standing on that unshielding plane that's left there. Could you stand up with the winds that blow? So I used to say the court, when they struck down the laws on abortion, they created this vast plain, and they found youngsters like that, like youngsters in their teens now caught on that empty plain with the winds blowing them without the advantage of those laws, those trees that set up shelter. So it's, you know, and the comedians are very good at this, getting the better of natural law. There was, Mel Brooks is not a subtle man in that movie. And by the way, the fact that people laugh is a sign that you get it. You get a good sense of what the American people understood about natural law by listening, as I do, to those Jack Benny programs I grew up in the 1940s. So it's quite clear that Jack Benny with a bow and arrow is lethal. And someone says, I bet you 10 cents you can't hit this apple off the head of Don Wilson. And Jack says, I'll take that bet. Don Wilson says, wait a minute, you can't do that. And Jack says, what's your problem? It's our money. So Mel Brooks does this movie, was it History of the World Part One? He says, he's a king of France. He says, pool. They shoot up a peasant to be shot. Shoots a peasant. It's a sport for kings. And Mel Brooks is again, it's not a subtle man. He understands the people out there will get the joke. And what is the joke? You don't throw away human life as a kind of plaything, right? Well, see, once you put that in place, then you set the ground for somebody saying, guess what? We have this new sport. I may enter into you. I may seed you. But don't worry. If anything happens, we can throw it away. We can throw it away. Hmm. The curious thing about that old line from Let Red Scout reflected is, God, they were much simpler people. We were much simpler 50 years ago, 60 years ago when I was growing up. But there's something about those primitive, those understandings. We know it's there. Somebody's pregnant. She's not carrying an orange or a pigeon. We know there's a baby out there. It's a great thing you do when you destroy that child in the womb. And therefore, we just put all kinds of cautions for young people. Be careful about putting yourself in that position where you have dire decisions to make that you may not have the wit or the means to make. There's problems to solve you may not solve.
Mm. That's one of the very poignant, I think, elements in the piece he wrote, is reflections on where the country how the country has shifted in the years since abortion started becoming legal and then post-Roe. And I was born in the early 90s. I've never known a world without Casey and without Roe. And it was always sort of perceived by a lot of people as an untouchable precedent. Definitely people that sort of grew up in the era that I did. But your reflections I found myself saying over the course of the last week that there's the moral integrity of the country has been restored on this question. Now, you will certainly disagree with me because of your disagreement with the opinion itself, which I think is completely accurate. And I think I'm wrong to say the moral integrity has been repaired. But what has been damaged, in your opinion, over all of the decades where abortion has been legalized and industrialized and embedded in the fabric of American culture? Well, what sort of... Go ahead.
I think you see the evidence all around you.
Yeah.
For some people, even people with college education, they affect not to know the nature of that thing in the womb. So they've never had a course in biology, never said it. How many people are simply willing to assume that thing is not there? It doesn't count. I have no judgment to make about what its standing is, what it is. I'm saying that you are really dispossessing me of some critical right for the sake of getting on with my life. I may need the license to destroy this innocent life. Mm. And the fact that we have so many of our people sounding this way is the lingering effect of what has been taught under Roe versus Wade. People were encouraged not to regard it seriously. I mean, Bill Clinton, remember, has an earnest statement vetoing the bill that barred the grisly partial birth abortion, where the head of the child was crushed, the content sucked out, the child moved out of the body, so to speak, in one piece. He had such earnest things to say on behalf of the woman who thought she needed that surgery, of the child whose brains were being crushed. He said nothing. What? It just doesn't count. What we've generated, see, in that earlier primitive time, when I reflected in that joke by Red Skelton, there's no mystery. You don't need a college education to know what was in the womb. Mm. But now we're in a world in which people with college education have been furnished now with theories, lines they could use so that they actually, it looks so, Emily, they do actually put out of sight God as something, as a nothing. The question of what is it you're killing? You recognize you're killing a right human being. And the question, how is it in this age of advanced education, people can excise those rudimentary facts of the situation and what we know about biology and genetics now? You say, people have done this. They've done a kind of moral surgery to themselves. What is it? What has accomplished this? How have we done it? The court, I'm afraid, has been the real engine. No, I think people, it's a strange people talk about culture is politics is downstream from culture. No, you forget the classic lessons of Aristotle and the Greeks. The laws teach. Mm-hmm. Court teaches that there's something rightful about abortion, something about it that should not be denied. People should not be deprived of it. They're doing nothing less than teaching the moral rightness of it. And people being stripped of it later was being not thought they were being stripped of some franchise improvidently assigned to them when the court exceeded its jurisdiction. They think they're being deprived of something morally right. And that's been the strange want of engagement here, that's meshing between the arguments that the conservative lawyers have talked themselves into and the underlying truth of the matter. It's that underlying truth of the matter that's kept people active in this field for so many years. But it's playing catch-up. We're playing catch-up. There are real disadvantages. We're sending this back to the states with the notion that there's no, we're not clear there's a human life here. You have to let you decide as to what is human life. If you want to have abortions, we can strip away all of the ingredients, from all the lingering inhibitions on abortion. So, well, what if Roe versus Wade is overturned? Well, what kind of a culture have you put in place? What kind of a moral teaching have you put in place for the next phase? And that's where the critical difference comes in between the more demanding understanding that was in place with the lawyers for Roe. And Roe versus Wade presented it. It was all there. There's nothing esoteric about it. It's the most natural thing for people to decide, to say, you're passing a law. You're overriding the private choice, restricting the personal freedom of somebody. When you do that, you understand it used to be that legislators had an obligation to explain what was justified in passing a law of that kind. They sought to do that in Rome. And they put in place the evidence on the baby in the womb and say, well, that's what we've lost. This is what conservative jurisprudence should have been talking about for the last 49 years. The fact that it has shifted, that it shifted the focus away from that is, I think, a mistake that regrettably will be having lingering effects with us as we try to work through this next phase of the problem.
Hmm. Hadley Arkes, you have been so generous with your time and with your insights. I appreciate it so very, very, very much.
And you have been so patient.
No. I was hanging on every word, truly.
I hope there are a few guides that you may be able to use. Okay.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. Hadley Arkes is the founder and director of the James Wilson Institute, as well as the Edward Ney Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence at Amherst College. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
Day. Stay.